Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. We are joined by an industry pro today.
We are pleased to introduce Ryan Canuel, who is the co-founder of Petrichor Games. Ryan and I met a couple of years ago. I was immediately taken with Petrichor's business model and some of the fun stuff that they're doing. Ryan, how are you?
I'm awesome. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be on.
Well, we are very excited to have you. So, Ryan, to get started, this is something we like to ask of all of our guests.
Because all of our guests are secret superheroes.
It's true. Please, tell us your origin story. Tell us how you got started in the industry.
Sure. So my path is very much tied in with Petrichor. We got started in the industry right out of college when we decided to start the studio. And the thing that kind of had me take the leap was an advisor and mentor that we have, Monty Sharma, who runs an organization, MassDigi, which is kind of like a games industry advocacy group. That works a lot with governments, but it's mostly New England based. Mm-hmm. So I had met him, and he kind of told me, I'd been talking with him about, hey, I really want to start a game studio at some point in my life, but I kind of thought very traditionally about it, right? Like you get a job at a studio in QA, and you kind of slowly work your way up, and once you've done it for 10, 15 years, you've built up the contacts and you know what you're doing, and then it makes sense to start your own business. And his advice was, well, like, why not just do it now, right? You're kind of,
yes,
you're at the best point in your life. You have very little to lose. And that was true. You know, I didn't really have much that anyone could take away from me if I screwed it all up. And so it was kind of ideal to say, yeah, like, let's take the jump. And friends of mine and, you know, people who I'd worked with, we all went to Becker College, which mm-hmm. is in Worcester, Mass, which is kind of in the middle of the state, and said, hey, you know, I gave them the same pitch. I said, well, let's just give it a year and see how it goes. It was started on studio. Worst case, you know, this all falls apart, and we can say, hey, we tried. It didn't work out, but we learned a lot. On the flip side, if it does work out, then we can say, well, we started our own studio and it worked out. And so that was kind of, it was a convincing enough argument that they all said yes. And, you know, then we got started with Petrichor. And we funded the studio from day one with client work, like work for hire. And the first work for hire project that we got, it was a result of that advisor, Monty Sharma. He put me in touch with a vascular surgeon that wanted to build an app. And so we were talking with him about the work for hire project. We were talking to a lawyer about getting the studio set up. And so I remember right before we started the studio, we had the work for hire project signed. We got the papers in that we were officially an organization. We got the official papers that day before we graduated from college. Then we graduated, and the day after we graduated, we got to work on the client project.
Wow. So
it was kind of a very immediate plunge right in. There wasn't really some people on the team took a vacation, but, you know, for me and some of the other co-founders, it was like, all right, we're going to get rolling on it.
That's a really great way to get started in the industry, though, because at that point, you haven't learned any bad habits. You haven't learned how everyone else is doing it. You just got to figure it out on your own. You just got to dive in and say, you know what? If there are pieces of this industry that are broken, we're not a part of it yet. We're going to figure out how to do it our way.
Yeah. And that's, you know, some people have kind of pushed back against when I say, you know, say, hey, this is how we did it. You know, not that it's the right way. You know, that there's a right way to do anything. But, you know, we looked at it and said, hey, likewise, you know, we don't really crunch as a studio long term for like every now and then there's something that comes up and someone has to step in, but very, very, very rarely. And we try to discourage it as much as possible. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think lessons like that where, you know, that was just kind of how it was done in some organizations, and people picked up those habits. We didn't really have anyone who had, you know, lessons like that or brought things like that into the studio. So we were kind of able to pick and choose from, you know, I'd listen to podcasts and, you know, read articles about how studios did it. And then we could kind of pick and choose what was right for us.
And how many of you, again, were there at the start?
There was six of us at the start.
That's a good core group.
Yeah, that really is.
That's a good number.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a big, and we very quickly, one of the original founders, it was about 2-3 months into the studio's founding, had to leave because, you know, we only had the one client project. Money was really tight. But out of the original six of us, four of the original teams, you know, 5 years later are still here. So
that speaks wonders to the kind of culture that Petrichor has built and continues to maintain.
Yeah. And how large are you now?
So in terms of employees, right now we have 8, and 6 of those are full-time and 2 are part-time. And then we've got some freelancers that we'll bring in to help with like audio. And we've got some collaborators that we've worked with, you know, on pretty much every project that we've done. They're not a full-time employee, but they're a part of the team.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk a little bit more about how the work for hire thing ended up working for Petrichor, because I know that the studio has leveraged, you know, non-games work to supplement the game development. And that, you know, that is a really interesting way of handling things. I've seen it from a couple of other studios that very much so bootstrap their way up through client work, but it was almost always game related. They were still working on video games. Why is it that Petrichor ended up going down this path of, nah, we're going to make games, but we want to make our games, and ending up supplementing that just outside of the game industry? Like, what was the ethos for that?
Sure. So we were pretty scrappy when we got started, and 5 years later, we still are. But we initially were like, you know, if someone has money and they'll pay us to do a certain project, we're not really going to be picky, unless it's, you know, completely against our morals and values, taking this project. You know, we were like, if it's an app, if it's a game, everyone really wanted to work on games, but we were realistic about the fact that we were starting with not a very large network of people that we knew. We hadn't worked professionally in games, so we didn't have that. You know, a lot of other founders that I'm friends with had worked at studios, and I ask, how'd you get your first early projects? And they go, well, you know, the place that I left, you know, they were subbing out projects, and so we just started doing that. Or, you know, a friend of mine went to go join another studio that I worked with for 6 years at X company, and so we didn't really have that.
Gotcha.
So we were kind of just looking to pick up whatever we could, and it just so happened that a friend of ours that had also graduated at the same time as us had gotten a job at a company that builds museum exhibits. And they were this company, they're called Boston Productions, and they're based right outside Boston. They're not actually in Boston. We did one project with them really early, which very quickly turned into 10, 15 projects in that one year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's ambitious.
So it's funny, you know, the types of projects that we did early and still a little bit to this day. Sorry, they like to race down my street.
the murder hornets, you mean? Because that's what that sounded like.
Oh God, they're coming!
They're coming for you. Run, Ryan.
So the projects that we do, like, we tend to take at least early on, and we're changing it a little bit now. But early on, a lot of those projects were smaller like projects. So they'd have, $10,000 budgets. And a lot of companies wouldn't necessarily pick up a project like that. Just say, hey, that's not, know, it's not a $50,000-$60,000 but project. Like, it's too small. It's spread over too long of a timeline. But we realized that we could take three or four of those and actually have just like one developer take all four of those. And the timelines were spread out in a way that the workload actually worked out pretty well with just a 40-hour work week. Like, you know, it wasn't as crazy as you thought it sounds. You know, it was feasible to take on that amount and spread it out. And so we also started getting really good at building them. The budgets were small, but we realized, okay, so it's a $10,000 project, but we can actually feasibly build this thing in 2 weeks of dev hours. And so then the math of, okay, like the hourly rate on that actually is pretty good. And so that was how we started really just taking on a ton of those projects. Was we got really good at making them. We liked making them. They were simple. And they were interesting, and we learned a lot from them. And that was kind of how we got started in that line of client work.
It's really interesting because that actually mirrors my experience working as a web designer and developer. Prior to getting into the game industry, I owned my own web studio, and I did a lot of that too, where I could take on a bunch of little projects and I could sub out the bits and pieces that I wasn't an expert with. So sometimes that was more intensive graphic design, and sometimes that was more extensive web development. But I love that. I love the approach of, look, we're not going to turn our noses up at the small stuff. We can just take on a little bit more of it because we've streamlined our process in such a way that it makes it easier for us to do the smaller stuff rather than commit to a $50,000, $60,000 project where that's going to be extremely complicated and that's going to be a lot more potential overhead of having to hire additional people. And my goodness, I can't even imagine what the back end of that project management would look like at something of that scope. But I feel this deeply, and I absolutely echo the importance of taking on those smaller projects to bootstrap yourself through those early years of your business. I did that for like, I don't know, 3-4 years of Violet Minded before I started moving on to the bigger stuff.
Yeah.
So,
you know, as we talk about that bootstrapping process, right, obviously finding those smaller projects is a big piece of it.
Totally.
You started with six of you as a core team. Did you, at that point, you know, in those early months, look around and go, okay, we've got all of our bases covered in terms of skill set, or some of our bases covered? And if it wasn't all, how did you go about filling in those skill gaps?
Sure. So we were pretty well covered. We had four developers, a artist who's very talented. She's 3D, 2D, UI. She can pretty much take on all, you know, the aspects of at least the projects that we were doing at the time. And I was more on the sales business development end, that I kind of like morphed into that role. So we were pretty well, the thing that's kind of interesting is I don't really do a lot of work on any of our client projects. Sometimes we've taken design jobs and I've done the documentation, or I've done like wireframe work when other people on the team have been busy. But my day-to-day is usually the sales and like project pipeline of what we have coming in, and it allows me to just focus on that.
Well, that's important stuff. I mean, the fact that you even had that skill set and that aptitude coming in on at the ground level and were able to shift into that role as business development and project management is great, because a lot of small studios, especially, you know, starting at the time in their life like you did, are developers, artists, sound engineers. You know, they're missing that business component. So the fact that you had that was wonderful.
Yeah, and I picked up a lot as I went. So I don't know how good I was out the gate, but over time, you know, it slowly kind of got better as we pick up projects and I understand, you know, what it took to bring them in. And you know, to celebrate our 5-year, I wrote a blog post on Gamasutra, and in that I mentioned that, you know, it was probably about a year to a year and a half before our first project came in that was actually a cold email/call that I finally just reached out and did a traditional sales on. But you know, I before that, it was all word of mouth through friends, advisors, people that we knew that led to those projects. So it took a long time to build that up.
Well, it seems like an important piece of advice. Now, Amanda, as you and I have talked, you had kind of a similar experience. You had a lot of word of mouth referrals for your business.
By the time I was ready to shut Violet Minded down, six years into it, because I was ready to move on to something else. I'd spent 15 years in web design at that point. I was like, I'm done, man. Trying to move on to something else. I've been making websites since I was 15 years old, and I'm 30, and I want to go be a writer. But yeah, everything towards the end of my business was all word of mouth. Like, I had built a reputation for running a solid team and for, you know, leading with generosity and kindness and compassion in the work that I did. That level of bootstrapping is super important when you're looking to elevate yourself from, hey, we don't know what the heck we're doing, to what you're doing now. But there have been challenges along the way. There have been challenges for the studio. There have been challenges for you individually, and there have been challenges for the work. So what have been some of the biggest challenges that Petrichor has faced in its 5 years since it was founded?
Yeah. So I think for us, a big challenge from day one, and for most businesses, is just keeping a constant stream of work in. It ebbs and flows, and there's kind of like the feast and famine cycles of sometimes there's so many projects I'm turning things down, and then other days it's like it seems like no matter who I reach out to, there isn't anything. So we've gone through those cycles now a few times, and early on we had weathered them fairly well, but around the start of last year in 2019, we went through this cycle of famine. There was the government shutdown had happened, so that kind of impacted some of the museum work.
Mm-hmm.
It was all delayed. We had two projects that were both big projects that we were bidding on, and we had one project that was ready to start. We were on the client call to kick off and get going, and it was a really cool, like, traveling exhibit. We were going to do, I think, 8 exhibits for it. We were rebuilding them all in Unity, and we were on the call with us and the partner and the client hadn't showed up. And then we got an email that there was some problems and they were sorting it out, and we'll talk again next week. And then I got a call from them that the funder of the overall thing was Raytheon, and Raytheon was merging with another company at the time. And so the CEO had said, we're putting all new projects on hold until the merger sorted out. So I was just killed right there because of this merger. So it was, it was that. And then we had another large project that I can't even remember why it didn't end up happening, but it was another kind of just strange circumstance. We're just not going to move forward with it right now. And so we stretched out as long as we could. We had been fortunate that we were profitable in prior months, mm-hmm. and we had some cash on hand, but we did eventually reach a point. At the time, there was 6 of us full time, and we had 4 developers all full time. We were kind of back to what we were at the start. We had some interns, and we cut the internships down. But then we finally just reached a point where we had to do layoffs, which, that was,
that's heartbreaking. Kind of,
that was tough for the people on the team. It was tough for me because it was my first time having to really go through something like that. And I'm very fortunate that we have advisors and mentors that I went to and talked about how to do it. We did it in a way where we try to be very transparent as a company about how things are at. So everyone kind of knew times were tough. And so we did meetings with everyone, and I, said, hey, well, how are things going? And they were like, I know they're not going well. So, we ended up 2 of the developers we had to let go, but we did it in like an advance notice. So I said, if things continue on this trend in a month and a half, I'm going to have to let you go. If we do get a project between now and then, I know that, things might change, but this is the circumstances. So we tried to, we didn't do like immediate, we need you to go home now. I wanted to give them some runway where they could at least look for something else, and then at least some hope was there if anything came through, which unfortunately it didn't. So we ended up letting them both go. And then we kind of, you know, it was a rough time after that, trying to get things back on track. And we were fortunate things picked up again. And then, you know, going into this year, you know, we hired again. Things have really picked up again. And, you know, pandemic aside, we're more busy than we've ever been. So
that's great.
That's very positive.
But that was probably the toughest time that we've gone through as a studio, just because, I think it's tough at any point, but you know, it's just, we're a small team. Mm-hmm. So that was particularly difficult.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been through, you know, layoffs. Amanda's been through layoffs and it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking on both sides. I was in nonprofits. I was in arts and culture in 2008 when the market crashed. I saw what that did to not only the organization that I was with, but other organizations in Rochester, New York, where I was living at the time. Amanda's been through media layoffs and it's tough. It's tough on those who are directly affected, and it's tough on those who, you know, quote, survive the layoffs.
Oh, because, yeah. You get mad survivor's guilt.
Yeah. And being the person who has to deliver that message, especially when you've advocated for a team as well, is very, very, but I'm really glad to hear that things are strong right now. We've talked a lot about your non-games work, but I want to make sure that we talk about your games. You guys have released a couple of games. You're about to release another one.
Oh yeah. I'm excited about this one.
Can you tell us a little bit about your games work, and then we'll talk about Dogfight?
You bet. Yeah. So, we've developed three games that are kind of our core games that we've launched as a studio. So our first game was called Mind the Arrow, kind of like Mind the Gap for the British trains. And that was a matching puzzle game with a literal twist. We launched that a few months after we started the studio. I think it was in July of 2015. And we got App Store featuring, Google Play feature, both were on the front page. And really cool, the official Apple App Store Facebook page shared our trailer.
Oh, and that's great.
Yeah, it was for our first game ever. People still ask, like, what's your favorite game you've done? And it's always Mind the Arrow, just I think because of the memories attached to it. Mm. But, you know, just we were like, we kind of realistically knew that for a mobile game, there was a pretty good chance we'd put it up and like there'd be 500 downloads, and it would be like our moms and like our friends, and and like we were emotionally prepared for that. And then to see it on the front page of the App Store, and then the App Store share it, and then to see articles pick it up and write about it was a really good feeling. So Mind the Arrow, that was our first. Then we did another game called Gelato Flicker, which was another kind of mobile matching puzzle game, which did a little bit better than Mind the Arrow. It didn't pick up as much attention, but in terms of downloads and the amount of revenue it brought in, it was a little bit better. And then we did a game called Battery Boy, which is in sort of a weird place. It's not released in the United States yet. But that was an endless runner that changed based on the battery life of your device that you were playing it on.
That's hysterical.
It's neat. In fact, this was part of our very first conversation way back at PAX East a few years ago.
Yeah. So we're still working on it to get it out in the U.S. It's out in China. It did really, really well in China. It was number 3 in arcade for its week of release.
Wow. And that's huge.
Yeah, we were really happy. So anyway, there's been a number of things that came up that's kind of prevented its release, but we're working towards it. We're also bringing it to TV boxes in China. We have a deal with a company there that we're bringing that and some of our other games. And so those are our prior games. We've done some demo prototype work. We did like our own game for Bose augmented reality beta devices that they had.
Oh, they're awesome glasses.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I saw those at Playcrafting in New York.
And that's how we got the, that's how we ended up in there, was actually we did one of the playcrafting game jams, and then we got some money from Bose to finish.
Oh.
But yeah, that, those are our previous games. And then Dogfight is our up and coming current project.
And it's that. Adorable.
It's so adorable. Cute. I want this game very badly. I saw it. I came and I stopped by. I think it was it this PAX, I think? I think it was this PAX. I was wandering around and y'all were there. And I checked out the game and it is adorable. I want to play it with my kids so bad.
Thank you. Yeah, we're super excited. We have seen an awesome response from families. And that's who we're targeting. And so it's been awesome to go to these events and have, you know, parents almost kind of be like, oh, like they just keep wanting me to drag them here to play. So, you know, it's, we're really excited. It's currently in development for PC, but we are confirmed for some consoles. So we're working towards that as well. We want to release in mid 2021. So we've got about another year worth of work on it. And we're currently working to look for a publisher, but you know, we're really excited by it. We've seen a really great response. We just put up the Steam page for wishlisting.
Oh, great!
Yeah, and we've seen a decent amount of people come in from the 5-year push that we did wishlisting it. So it is available right now. You know, if anyone's interested, to go and wishlist on Steam.
Absolutely, excellent. We'll go ahead and we'll drop that link into the show notes as well.
Absolutely. So to wrap things up, you know, obviously Petrichor has taken a very non-traditional route in how it's been structured and how the work has come in and everything like that. So what kind of advice would you give a couple of, you know, like a couple of folks that are either coming out of AAA and they're looking to start up their own indie studio? And what kind of advice would you give to yourselves 5 years ago?
Sure. So I think one big thing that looking back was so important for us was just having mentors and advisors who could help guide us. I mean, it was just, especially I think in the position that we were in where we just didn't know as much, but having someone who had been through it, they'd started several companies, they just could really help guide. And, you know, I remember there was times where on client projects, we had one project early on where we had not clearly articulated to the client what an alpha phase was. So he had one idea and we had another. And so, it was obviously very rough. Mm-hmm. So we sent him the alpha version. And needless to say, he wasn't very happy with it. And it was our only project. So I got this like really long email that was like, this is terrible, you know, like,
oh, no.
And so I was like, oh God, what do I do? And so I was like late in the night and I was able to talk to our advisor and he kind of helped me like, all right, here's just, you need to respond to him. You need to explain what the alpha is. You need to tell him what beta will be and what will be in that, you know? And so it really kind of helped like calm me down. It helped me through that. And so having someone like that is just incredibly helpful. And, you know, like aside from that, just understanding how to structure the company and how to, you know, when we had to do layoffs, like how to talk about that or how to, you know, how to do the right thing in terms of just like being transparent. And a lot of that guidance came from advisors and mentors that I made. So that's always, you know, my big advice is if there's someone who you really look up to, you know, just reach out and see if there's, you know, I'm always surprised by when I email people, their willingness to just help. And, you know, I think, you know, people are genuinely good and always, you know, want to help and not see people go through the same mistakes that they've made. So that's always my big advice is, you know, reach out for help and ask for it because, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are willing to give it.
I think that's great. I think that's a fantastic place to wrap this conversation. Ryan, thank you so, so much for sharing your story with us, for coming to talk with us about Petrichor. So, like, I wanted to, like, tell this story about how you've kind of blended, you know, the games and non-games work since our very first conversation. So I'm glad that finally we're able to find a great format for that. Yeah, so thank you.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you for having me.
No problem. And, you know, we love indies here at Virtual Economy.
We do.
And
in case that isn't obvious.
Yes. It should be obvious.
It should be.
If you're an indie developer and you would like to share your work on the show, please DM us at Virtual Econcast or shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
This has been episode 19.
It has been.
People keep listening to us.
They do.
That's kind of impressive, actually.
I appreciate it.
All right. So thank you for listening to episode 19 of Virtual Economy. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I'm at Amanda Farrow.
And I'm at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H. Ryan, where can people find you online?
I am at Ryan Canuel, R-Y-A-N-C-A-N-U-E-L. Or you can follow Petrichor at PetrichorGames.com or at Petrichor Games on Twitter.
Amazing. You can also find us, if this is your first time to Virtual Economy, because you came to us by way of, you know, the rest of the internet. You can also find our RSS feed. We are virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's libsyn.com/RSS. You can also find us on every major podcast provider, except for iHeartRadio, because we're just babies and they won't let us on there for another, like, 4 months.
Soon.
Soon. So that means you can listen to us for free on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, Pocket Cast, basically anywhere where you can look up our podcast, Virtual Economy, you can find us. The most important thing to do for us, if you like what we're doing here, make sure that you subscribe. It tells the algorithm gods that we are worth paying attention to and that, you know, it's not just our moms that listen to us.
Our moms love us. And we love our listeners, and we love listener questions. So if you are a listener with a question for us about something cool that's happening in the news or for one of our guests, please go ahead and DM us at Virtual Econcast or shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz. And speaking of F Squared, we're open for business.
Yeah, we launched a business, friends. We definitely did.
So F Squared, for those of you who aren't aware, we are doing consulting work. We're doing mock previews, mock reviews. We are available to provide strategy, consultation, messaging, advice, marketing, PR consultation, that sort of thing.
Pitch deck review is another big one.
We are still doing pro bono work. If you are a up-and-coming developer, if you don't have a lot of money, if you just need to bounce a couple questions off of somebody or get a quick pitch deck review...
This goes for both digital games and tabletop games.
Absolutely.
We recently did some work with a tabletop developer that, you know, it was an hour and a half of my time and, you know, we were able to help set this developer up for success. So yeah. That's what we want. We heart indies.
It's true. You can find out more at www.fsquared.biz. And that's a wrap.
That's it. We did it. Episode 19 in the bag.
Yeah, we'll be back soon. In the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you next week.